Glinka died in February of 1857. He did not just become a national hero, he was canonized, he was deified. "Beethoven and Glinka!" exclaimed Anton Rubinstein. And Rubinstein's Russian contemporaries saw nothing exaggerated in this coupling. Among those who believed most fervently in Glinka's musical godhood was a young 20-year-old pianist and composer living in St. Petersburg by the name of Mily Alexeyevich Belakarev. Belakarev lived from 1837 to 1910. Please, Belakarev and the Five. Despite his minimal musical training, Belakarev set himself up as a music teacher and quickly became the czar of Russian music. What resulted when Belakarev put out his shingle and started gathering students remains one of the strangest things that has ever happened in music and could only have taken place in Russia in the mid-19th century, with this huge talent pool and nowhere for that talent pool to go for training. I will let Harold Schoenberg begin the story. Around Belakarev gathered a group of young musicians who were to become known as the Russian Five, a group of self-taught dilettantes active in other fields. Cesar Cui, in 1856, was the first to be attracted to the Belakarev orbit. Cui, who was born in 1835 and died in 1918, was an army officer and remained one to the end of his life. He was an engineer, and his specialty was fortifications. As a composer, he was the least talented of the five. He was more valuable as a critic. His articles appeared in France as well as in Russia, and he was constantly explaining the nationalistic principles of the five. Modest Mussorgsky, 1839 to 1881, was the next to enter the circle. He appeared to be an unlikely candidate for immortality. At that time, in 1857, he was an 18-year-old ensign in the crack Preobrajensky Regiment and had been taught what every good regimental officer of the Preobrajensky had to know: how to drink, how to wench, how to wear clothes, how to gamble, how to flog a serf, and how to sit on a horse. Of this set of accomplishments, Mussorgsky found drinking most congenial. His other big accomplishment was his ability to play the piano, his repertoire consisting of fashionable potpourris of the day. Alexander Borodin, then an army medical officer, met Mussorgsky in 1856 while both were duty officers at the same hospital. Borodin wrote of his first impression of Mussorgsky: "I had just been appointed an army doctor, and Mussorgsky was a newly hatched officer. Being on hospital duty, we met in the common room, and feeling bored and in need of companionship, we started talking and found each other most congenial. The same evening, we were invited to the army doctor's house. Having a grown-up daughter, he often gave parties to which the officers on duty were asked." Mussorgsky was at that time a very callow, most elegant, perfectly contrived little officer. Carefully smoothed out, brand-new, close-fitting uniform, toes well turned out, hair well oiled, hands shapely and well cared for. His manners were polished and aristocratic. He spoke through his teeth, and his carefully chosen words were interspersed with French phrases and were rather labored. He showed, in fact, signs of slight pretentiousness, but also, quite unmistakably, of perfect breeding and education. He sat down at the piano and, coquettishly raising his hands, started playing delicately and gracefully bits of Trovatore and Traviata, the circle around him rapturously murmuring, "Charmant, delicious, charming, delicious." Music was what Mussorgsky loved above all. So overwhelming was the impact of Belakarev upon him that Mussorgsky resigned his commission in 1857 and plunged madly into the study of music. This is as far as we can go in this lecture. When we return for the next lecture, the remainder of the five and how they came to know Belakarev, and then, of course, we will focus specifically on Mussorgsky and his superb opera, Boris Godunov. Thank you. Thank you. Welcome back to How to Listen to and Understand Opera. This is Lecture 30, the second of a two-lecture set entitled Russian Opera. Where we left off, we were talking about the accumulation of what we now call the Russian Five. Balakirev is the teacher, the heart and soul of this group of young composers. The first to join Balakirev's circle was Cesar Cui, an army engineer. The second to join Balakirev's circle was Modest Mussorgsky, an army officer. We continue. Into the Balakirev circle next came the young naval officer, Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov, 1844 to 1908. Alexander Borodin joined the Balakirev circle in 1862, and he is the fifth and last of what we call the Five. Borodin's dates, 1833 to 1887, was the illegitimate child of Prince Luka Gedeonashvili. He was trained as a scientist and remained one his entire life. So there they are, my friends, the army engineer, the ex-ensign, the naval cadet, and the chemist. This group of what was initially hobbyists changed the face of Russian music forever. Not since the Florentine Camerata has a group of dilettantes and semi-professionals had such a profound effect on the history of Western music. Cesar Cui on the Russian Mighty Handful. Yes, Cui wrote so much about the group, and he describes their process of education. By the way, this phrase, Mighty Handful, is translated roughly into Russian, or should I say the Russian that's translated into the Mighty Handful, is Moguche Kuchka. Moguche Kuchka means literally the magnificent few, and we've translated that rather more gracefully into English as the Mighty Handful, a handful being five. I read from Cui's reminiscence. We formed a close-knit group of young composers, and since there was nowhere to study, for us the conservatory didn't exist, our self-education began. It consisted of playing through everything that had been written by all the greatest masters, and all aspects were subjected to criticism and analysis in all their technical and creative aspects. We were young, and our judgments were harsh. I would add they were also a little ignorant. I continue. We were very disrespectful in our attitude towards Mozart and Mendelssohn. To the latter, we opposed Schumann, who we then ignored. We were very enthusiastic about Liszt and Berlioz, and we worshipped Chopin and Glinka. And this is completely understandable, that they would worship nationalist composers of the highly expressive mid and early 19th century. I continue. We carried on heated debates, in the course of which we would down as many as four or five glasses of tea with jam. We discussed musical form, program music, vocal music, and especially opera. Unquote. Their lack of schooling in traditional music theory forced the five to discover their own way of doing things. And in the process, they called on the materials closest at hand, which were, my friends, folk songs. Their frequent use of actual or imitated folk material for generating themes in a work has literary parallels in the borrowings by Pushkin and Gogol of folk tales as the basis of so many of their most characteristic stories. Self-taught and proud of it, the five made a virtue of their technical ignorance and raised the flag of their dogmatic nationalism at every opportunity. To the five, the great enemies of Russian music were the Rubinstein brothers, Nikolai and Anton. Anton Rubinstein, pianist and composer, founded the St. Petersburg Conservatory in 1862. Nikolai Rubinstein, pianist, founded the Moscow Conservatory in 1864. For the five, the Rubinsteins represented the Western European academic tradition and the ongoing threat of Western musical dominance over native Russian music. Cesar Cui wrote, "It would be a serious error to consider Anton Rubinstein a Russian composer. He is merely a Russian who composes." Unquote. Balakirev considered the St. Petersburg Conservatory, and now I quote, "a plot to bring all Russian music under the yoke of the German generals." Unquote. Modest Mussorgsky wrote a letter to Rimsky-Korsakov dated August 15, 1868. I read that letter. And another thing about German symphonic development. I tell you, our cold kvass soup is a horror to the Germans, and yet they eat it with pleasure. And their cold cherry soup is a horror to us, and yet it sends a German into ecstasy. In short, symphonic development is just like German philosophy and soup, all worked out and systematized. When a German thinks, he reasons his way to a conclusion. Our Russian brother, on the other hand, starts with the conclusion and then might amuse himself with some reasoning. Just keep one thing in mind. The creative act carries within itself its own aesthetic laws. Their verification is inner criticism. Their application is the artist's instinct. The artist is a law unto himself. When an artist revises, it means he's dissatisfied. When he revises, although satisfied or worse, adds to what already satisfies, he is Germanizing, chewing over what has already been said. We Russians are not cud chewers. We are omnivores. Unquote. This is real Moguće Kučka dogma. Say that five times, if you will. It goes without saying that the academicians did not like the five. For example, Tchaikovsky expressed his opinions regarding the five in a letter dated January 5, 1878. Tchaikovsky's letter pretty much expresses what most educated Russian musicians thought of the five. And I quote Tchaikovsky. All the Petersburg composers are afflicted to the marrow with the worst sort of conceit and with a purely dilettantish confidence in their superiority over all the rest of the musical world. Cui is a dilettante. His music is devoid of originality. Bardeen is a 50-year-old professor of chemistry at the Academy of Medicine. He has even less taste than Cui, and his technique is so weak that he can't write a line without outside help. Mussorgsky is a has-been. In talent, he exceeds all the others, but lacks the need for self-perfection. Balakirev has grown silent after accomplishing very little. He has gifts, and they are lost because of some fateful circumstance that has made a saintly prig out of him. This, then, is my honest opinion of these gentlemen. What a sad thing. With the exception of Rimsky-Korsakov, how many talents from whom it is futile to await anything worthwhile? And is this not generally the way in Russia? Tremendous powers fatally hindered by a sort of plevna from taking the field and enjoining battle as they should. Nevertheless, these powers exist. Even a Mussorgsky, by his very lack of discipline, speaks a new language. It is ugly, but it is also fresh. Like it or not, a characteristically Russian music emerges from the five based on the model of Glinka, a music that employs Russian folk melodies or melodies created to sound like folk melodies. Two, a music that is essentially thematic with little of the sort of development we would hear in German music. And three, a music that is rhythmically powerful, lyric, and often to Western ears, emotionally unrefined. All right, Modest Petrovich Mussorgsky, 1839 to 1881. He is the first of the five to compositionally mature. He is known for but a handful of works. Sensational songs, my friends. His operas, Boris Godunov and Kovachina, and instrumental works, such as The Night on Bear Mountain and Pictures at an Exhibition. Depression and alcohol led Mussorgsky to a very early death. Alexander Borodin lamented Mussorgsky's downfall. This is horribly sad. Such a talented man and sinking so low. Now he periodically disappears, then reappears, morose, untalkative, which is contrary to his usual habit. After a while, he comes to himself again, sweet, gay, amiable, and as witty as ever. Devil knows what a pity. Unquote. Mussorgsky's great friend, the artist Ilya Repin, chronicled Mussorgsky's disintegration, and again I quote, "It was really incredible how that well-bred guards officer, with his beautiful and polished manners, that witty conversationalist with the ladies, that inexhaustible punster, quickly sank, sold his belongings, even the elegant clothes, and soon descended to some cheap saloons where he personified the familiar type of the has-been, where this childishly happy child with a red potato-shaped nose was already unrecognizable. Was it really he, the once impeccably dressed, heel-clicking society man, scented, dainty, fastidious? Oh, how many times our friend Stasov, on his return from abroad, was hardly able to get him out of some basement dive, nearly in rags, swollen with alcohol. Mussorgsky died of a stroke on March 16th of 1881. He was only 42 years old. Boris Godunov. Story. The story takes place between 1598 and 1605 and is based on historical events. Boris Godunov is the chief minister and brother-in-law of Tsar Feodor. For his own power-hungry ends, Boris arranges for the assassination of the heir to the throne, young Dmitri, the Tsar's half-brother. On the death of Tsar Feodor, Boris has himself acclaimed by the people and ascends the throne. Now, at about the same time, a young monk named Grigory leaves his monastery and goes to Poland, where he passes himself off as the dead Tsarevich Dmitri. All right, you're still all with me. Let's continue. The Polish government puts this pretender at the head of a Polish army and marches against Russia. Russia is almost defenseless. Boris, plagued by guilt and nightmares over the assassination of the young Dmitri, is incapable of action. Boris dies, and the former monk, Grigory, posing as Dmitri, ascends the throne and becomes Tsar. My friends, there are six different versions of this opera. Quickly. Mussorgsky completed the original version in 1869 after 15 months of work. This version was rejected outright for performance. Mussorgsky's friends convinced him to rewrite the opera, which he did. He went so far as to add a whole other act, the act we now know as the third act. This second version was completed in 1874. It was premiered that year and enjoyed modest success. It was performed 21 times before it disappeared from the repertoire in 1879. Okay. Now, after Mussorgsky died, his great friend Rimsky-Korsakov decided to rewrite Boris as a tribute to Mussorgsky. I quote Rimsky, "I worship Boris Godunov, and I hate it. I worship it for its originality, power, boldness, independence, and beauty. I hate it for its shortcomings, the roughness of its harmonies, the incoherence in the music. Although I know I shall be cursed for doing so, I will revise Boris. There are countless absurdities in its harmonies and at times its melodies. Unfortunately, Mussorgsky's followers will never understand," unquote. So Rimsky did a version in 1896, and then he did another version in 1908. And this second Rimsky-Korsakov version, the fourth version of Boris Godunov, is the version typically heard today and the one which we will hear in just a moment. Not content, however, Karl Rathaus did another version, and Dmitri Shostakovich did a sixth version. The structure of the opera consists of a prologue followed by four acts. In truth, it's a series of set pieces, or what we would call tableaus, each illuminating an episode from the life and death of Boris. Cesar Cui wrote of Boris Godunov, quote, "Each scene is independent. The roles, for the greater part, are transitory. The episodes necessarily have a certain connection. They all relate more or less to a common action. But the opera would not suffer from a rearrangement of the scenes, nor even from a substitution of certain secondary episodes by others. This is a result of the fact that Boris, properly speaking, is neither a drama nor an opera, but rather a musical chronicle after the manner of the historical dramas of Shakespeare," unquote. Boris Godunov is based on a dramatic chronicle by Alexander Pushkin. Mussorgsky himself wrote the libretto. Central to Mussorgsky's libretto are two essential issues. One, the relationship between ruler and those who are ruled, and two, the corrupting influence of power. Lord Acton's famous comment applies well to Boris. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Great men are almost always bad men. Eric Plaut points out, the relationship between the hopelessly poor peasants and their all-powerful, frequently savage and yet perennially vulnerable czars is a dominant theme in Russian history. With the prescience of genius, Mussorgsky chose a subject that continued to dominate Russia in the century after the opera was written, a nation so fearful of its foes that it found security in a dictatorial leader, a governmental process characterized by endless struggles for accession to power and by government savagery in the name of law and order. Throughout the opera, there are repeated references to the people's fear of the Tsar, his cruelty, his ruthlessness. Yet Mussorgsky makes it quite clear that, much as they fear a strong Tsar, the people fear being without a strong Tsar even more. Historically, the fear was well-founded. Whenever Muscovite Russia had been without a strong ruler, she had been sacked repeatedly by Mongols, Poles, Tartars, and Cossacks, her citizens slaughtered and sold into slavery. Only a powerful and ruthless Tsar had proven capable of containing the nobility and its internecine warfare that led to national chaos, unquote. No composer ever portrayed as sympathetically as Mussorgsky did the peasant class. Central to this sympathetic portrayal is Mussorgsky's attitude towards musical prosody, the accurate reproduction of Russian speech patterns in music. Again, I quote Mussorgsky. I should like to make my characters speak on the stage exactly as people do in real life, without exaggeration or distortion, and just write music that will be thoroughly artistic. What I project then is the melody of life. This is living prose in music. This is reference for the language of humanity. This is a reproduction of simple human speech. I want the notes to express exactly what the words express. I want truth. Unquote. My friends, Monteverdi could not have said it better himself. Boris Godunov, the music. Prologue, 1598, Boris's accession to the throne of Russia. Scene 2, about 15 minutes into the opera, an extraordinary contrast. The boyars, the Russian aristocrats, ranked just below the ruling princes, have announced the accession of Boris to an ecstatic populace. The boyars, long live Tsar Boris Theodorovich, the people. Long may he live, like the radiant sun in the sky. Glory, 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 glory to the Tsar, to Boris, the Tsar of Russia. Glory, 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 glory. Slava, 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 slava. And it's a magnificent and ecstatic celebration. And then immediately, in stark contrast, a fearful Boris, filled with misgivings and guilt, prays for a successful rule. My soul is sad. Some sort of involuntary fear has gripped my heart with a sense of evil foreboding. O righteous one, O sovereign father of mine, look down from the heaven on the tears of your faithful servants and send me a holy blessing for my rule. Let me be good and righteous as you are. May I rule my people in glory. Now let us pay our respects to the past rulers of Russia, now deceased. And now invite the people to the feast. All, from boyar to blind beggar, let everyone enter. You are all welcome. Note, please, the melodies are tinged with a absolutely Slavic, Russian melodic sensibility. Note, too, that Boris is a bass. No surprise, again, the Russian predilection for the bass voice. 3, Mussorgsky's incredible prosody in Boris's aria. We have a syllabic setting fitted to the needs of the Russian language. We have the clarity of recitative and the melodic fluency and expressive power of aria. Quite magnificent, and again, quite Russian-sounding as opposed to Italian, French, or German music. We move on to Varlam's song. During the first act, we meet a drunken old priest named Varlam. He sings a raucous drinking song about the destruction of the Tatars at the hands of Tsar Ivan the Terrible. Varlam's song makes a very interesting contrast with Farlov's Rondo from Glinka's Ruslan and Ludmilla, where Farlov's song was clearly, indebted to the pater aria style of Italian opera buffa. Varlam's song has nothing to do with Italian opera. It is a rough, folkish, and in its rhythms and prosody, thoroughly Russian song. I would read it to you now. Varlam, here's what happened at the town of Kazan. Ivan the Terrible was feasting and making merry. He had given the Tatars a ruthless beating to teach them a lesson, not to go wandering in Russia again. The Tsar came close to the little town of Kazan. He dug some trenches under the river of Kazan. As the Tatars strolled about the town, they stole glances at Tsar Ivan, those evil Tatars. Ivan the Terrible became sad. He hung his head on his right shoulder. The Tsar sent for all the gunners with all their guns, the gunners with all their guns. A bright wax taper started smoking. A young gunner went up to the barrel, and the barrel of gunpowder started rolling. Help! It rolled along the trenches until it exploded. Oh, the evil Tatars shrieked and screamed, cursing in foul language. Hordes of Tatars fell. 43,000 Tatars fell. That's what happened in Kazan. Ha-ha! Varlam's song.
Как во городе было в Казани, грозный царь пировал, да веселился. Он татары бил нещадно бы, чтоб им было неповадно бы вдоль по Руси гулять. Царь под воду подходил, да под Казань городок. Он под копы подкопал, да под Казанку, под реку. Как татари да по городу похаживают, на царя Ивана типа глядывают. Святотары подчинился. Он повесил галушку на правое плечо. Уж как стал царь, уж скорей зывать, уж скорей со зажигальщиков, зажигальщиков. Задымило со свечка воску ярого, подходил молодой пушкарь от почечки, а и с порохом та бочка загружилась, ой, а топом погодилась, да и хлопнула. А вопили, заголдились и топорами, магиматом заливались, полегло татары почучая, полегло их 40 тысяч, до 3000. Как во городе было показано.
We move forward to Act 4, Scene 2, The Death of Boris, one of the most moving scenes really in all of opera. Boris, who has hovered at the very edge of madness since the second act, and please remember, it's the guilt over the execution of the young Dmitri that has caused this madness, this kind of feedback in Boris's mind. We now visit him at a moment of lucidity. As his death approaches, he calls for his son, Fyodor, the Tsarevich. Boris says, "Farewell, my son, I am dying. Now you will begin your reign. Do not ask me by what means I obtained the crown. You need not know. You will be a lawful ruler, as my successor, as my firstborn son, as my son, my dear child. Don't believe the slander of the seditious boyars. Keep a sharp watch on their secret dealings with Lithuania. Punish treason harshly, punish without mercy. Closely follow the judgment of the people. They are impartial. Defend and guard the righteous faith. Honor and respect the holy saints of the Lord." And then I would tell you this next bit is exquisitely sweet and moving. "Look after your sister, the Tsarevna, my son. You are now her only guardian, Arzenia, the innocent dove." Look, Boris's pain here is doubled. He knows that the Polish army, with the pretender Grigory Dmitri, is approaching. Polish victory, seemingly inevitable at this point, will undoubtedly mean the death of his beloved children. In himself being responsible for the death of Dmitri, he has also now been responsible, as he anticipates, for the death of his own. O Lord, look down, I pray, upon the tears of a sinful father. I'm not praying for myself, not for myself, my Lord. From your inaccessible height, pour down your blessing light upon my children, my innocent, my sweet, pure children. O heavenly powers, guardians of the eternal throne, with your bright wings protect my dear child from all evils and calamity, from temptation. At that moment, he hugs his son and kisses him. A long-sustained chime of a bell is heard. It is Boris's death knell, and Boris is hearing it in his own mind. Boris says, "A bell! A knell!" A chorus of monks sings from offstage, and again, this is all happening in Boris's mind. The monks are grieving for the dead Tsarevich Dmitri. They're not grieving for Boris. "Weep, weep, O people! There is no life in him anymore. His lips are silent, and he will never give an answer. Weep. Alleluia." Then boyars and the chorus come onto the stage. Boris says, "Funeral wails, the monastic order, the holy monastic order. The Tsar is joining the monks." And the death knell continues underneath the voices. Fyodor, Boris's son, says, "Your Majesty, calm down. The Lord will help." And Boris responds, "No, no, my son. My time has come." Again, the chorus in Boris's mind sings of the dead Tsarevich Dmitri. "I can see the dying child, and I weep and sob. He tosses and turns and calls for help, but nothing can save him. And Boris yells out, "Oh, Lord, oh, Lord, I feel terrible. There's nothing I can do now to atone for my sin. Oh, evil death, how cruel are your torments." And he jumps up. "Wait, wait, I am still Tsar." But then he clutches his heart and falls into a chair. "I am still Tsar. Oh, Lord, death, forgive me." And then points to his son. "Here, here is your Tsar, forgive me." And in a whisper, "Forgive me." The boyars, in a whisper, say, "He has died." This is a three handkerchief or $2 of Kleenex section. Please, let's listen to the death of Boris.
Прощай, мой сын, умираю. Сейчас ты царствовать начнешь. Не спрашивай, каким путем я царство приобрел. Тебе не нужно знать, ты царствовать по праву будешь, как мой наследник, как сын мой первородный. Стражи трона предвечного.
Boris remains one of the really great tragic heroes in all of opera. We weep for him, even if he cannot weep for himself. Destroyed by his guilt over what he's done to gratify his lust for power, Boris, in the end, can neither save himself nor the lives of his children. And that's what's so touching about this last scene. It is his children, his love for his children, that comes through at the moment of his death. The power, the accoutrement It's meaningless to him. He just wants safety for his family, and it's the one thing he knows he cannot guarantee. I would point out before my concluding remarks that the old divisions of recitative and aria are in Russian opera almost from the beginning inconsequential. If we hear recitative-like music, it will always be accompanied by the orchestra. And I would point out the effortless ease with which Mussorgsky moves from recitative-like music through more melodic arioso to genuine aria and chorus and back again. Certainly the divisions of aria and recitative that we talked about for so much of this course have been pretty much done away with, the model of Verdi having much to do with that, by the 1850s and certainly by the 1860s. Boris is a superb opera. It is the pinnacle of 19th century Russian opera, a tradition begun but 38 years before with Glinka's A Life for the Tsar. Boris Godunov is to 19th century Russian opera what Verdi's Otello, Wagner's Tristan and Isolde, and Bizet's Carmen are to 19th century Italian, German, and French opera, a spectacular culmination of what had come before, the best of its national type, and frankly, a very difficult, if not impossible, act for anyone else to follow. Thank you. Welcome to How to Listen to and Understand Opera. This, my friends, is Lecture 31, the first of a two-lecture set entitled Verismo, Puccini, and Tosca. First, Verismo opera definitions. Through the second half of the 19th century, Italian and French writers and opera composers sought to capture ever greater dramatic truth in their works. This meant portraying people, events, and emotions with ever greater accuracy without the sort of artifice we hear in Meyerbeer's The Huguenots, or for that matter, in Rossini's The Barber of Seville. Bizet's Carmen, Verdi's Otello, and the works of the writer Émile Zola, for example, shoot from the emotional hip. They all portray real people in profoundly weakened and often degraded emotional states, struggling for their very survival as human beings. This move towards stark, dramatic, and expressive realism is called in opera in Italy, verismo, meaning simply truth, or even more accurately, truthism. Now the textbooks will tell us that verismo opera grew out of a 19th century philosophy called positivism. So bear with me for a moment while we go through these isms and dogma, and in doing so, seek the greater truth and apply it to the opera of late 19th century Italy. In any case, the textbooks tell us that verismo opera grew out of a 19th century philosophy called positivism. Positivism posits that personkind had outgrown theology and metaphysics, that the only reality one should concern oneself with was observable fact. Positivism assumed that there were no mysteries left in the world that science could not explain. A mid-19th century offshoot of positivism was a philosophical and artistic movement called naturalism. So an offshoot of this positivism, which is a very intellectual look at the world, is a movement called naturalism. The object of naturalism was to understand logically and scientifically the essence of human society, that is, human relationships, human interaction, how human society functioned, and what the effects of society were on individual people. According to Émile Zola, naturalism was, quote, the formulas of modern science, that is, positivism, applied to literature, unquote. David Kimball writes, Like realism, naturalism tended to concentrate its attentions on areas socially neglected by earlier literary movements: lowlife, the criminal, the dispossessed, the demoralized. In some measure, this was due to the political tendency of this movement. But there was also an artistic reason for this choice of celebrating and examining the dispossessed, the criminal, the lowlife. The realists looked to such worlds for simplicity, for authenticity, for the absence of pose and artifice. The naturalists preferred them, that is, the lowlife, the dispossessed, the criminals, because the relationship between society and its victims was much more interesting than the relationship between society and successful men and women. My friends, we are still positive naturalists today in this way. If we turn on the TV set, we are much more likely to see a television show about criminals, about cops, about hospitals that celebrate the victimized and dispossessed, than we are likely to see a TV show about a wealthy, happy, philanthropic financier. People who have already made their way in the world are not as interesting as those who are not making their way in the world. And so naturalism, verismo, positivism all celebrate the underside of human society. And this is what so many writers in France and Italy were interested in as we move towards the close of the 19th century. In Italy, according to the textbooks, operatic naturalism, realism, or verismo began with Pietro Mascagni's opera, Cavalleria Rusticana in 1890, and Ruggero Leoncavallo's I Pagliacci in 1892. All right, this might be what the textbooks say, that verismo opera begins in 1890, but in reality, if you'll excuse me, Italian operatic verismo had existed since at least Verdi's La Traviata of 1853. Real people, real situations, real victims, real illness. The great operatic exponent of Italian verismo opera was Giacomo Antonio Domenico Michele Secondo Maria Puccini. According to Robert Donington, Puccini is much the best of verismo, and Tosca may well be the best of Puccini. Giacomo Puccini, 1858 to 1924. Not long before he died, Puccini wrote to a friend, "Almighty God touched me with his little finger and said, 'Write for the theater, mind, only for the theater.' And I have obeyed that supreme command." Puccini once described himself quite accurately, apparently, as, and again I quote, "a mighty hunter of wildfowl, opera libretti, and attractive women," unquote. Puccini's career would seem to be, if not a short one, then at least constrained by not that many operas. He only wrote 12 operas in total. Three of them are one-act operas designed to be performed together, that is the work Il Trittico. And one of these 12 operas, Turandot, was left incomplete at the time of his death. Yet three of Puccini's operas remain really among, if not the most popular in the repertoire. They are, of course, Tosca, La Bohème, and Madame Butterfly, with Turandot and Manon Lescaut not far behind. Puccini's life can be outlined fairly quickly. He was born in Lucca on December 22nd of 1858, literally in the shadow of Verdi. Oh, I can't resist pointing out a wonderful bit of trivia. December 22nd of 1808 was the night of this incredible concert in Vienna, the night that Beethoven premiered his 5th and 6th symphonies, reperformed the 4th piano concerto, and introduced any other number of very important pieces in a 4-hour-long concert in a freezing cold recital hall. Puccini was born on the 50th anniversary of that incredibly auspicious evening in Beethoven's life. It's an absolutely useless detail, but such details, of course, are what make life worth living. Puccini was the last, as it turned out, of a line of five generations of respected musicians. Puccinis had been professional musicians in Lucca since 1712. So this was a family thing. It was understood that a Puccini son would be musical, would be trained in music, and would likely become a professional musician. Now, he was apparently a lazy, indifferent student. One of his teachers reported, quote, "He comes to school only to wear out the seat of his pants," unquote. I would not be very satisfied if one of my children brought that back on his or her report card, but this is just how Puccini was. Whether he was lazy or indifferent is unimportant. He was good enough musically to be accepted and to attend the Milan Conservatory of Music. This is that same Milan Conservatory that rejected Verdi. So certainly as a young man, Puccini's chops were adequate to move on to the higher level of musical education that a conservatory would offer. His main teacher at the conservatory was Amilcare Ponchielli, who is the composer of La Gioconda, I Lituani, and a host of other popular late 19th century Italian operas. Puccini's first opera was Le Villi of 1884. He was 26 years old. Puccini's first huge success, and indeed the opera that made him both rich and famous, was La Bohème. It was written in 1896 when Puccini was 38 years old. Puccini is to Verdi what Strauss was to Richard Wagner, the successor who could not possibly top his role model. Sometimes I think we expect much too much of Puccini. How could anyone be expected to walk in the footsteps of Verdi? Puccini was not an innovator, but even across the span of his career, we see no great difference in his last opera, Turandot, than we see in his first great successful work, La Bohème, whereas Verdi, of course, evolved constantly, forever seeking greater drama and greater movement. Puccini was not controversial. Puccini was apolitical. He was not particularly interested in the musical scene around him. Puccini was, as he told us at the very beginning of this lecture, a man of the theater. Period. Exclamation mark. So, let us please take Puccini at face value. He was a superb and sympathetic melodist who brought his other compositional skills to bear directly on the dramatic necessities before him. Stage action, impulsive feeling, and truth in expression, verismo in expression. Before we move on, we've got to talk about what I would call the Puccinian dilemma. Now, many important critics, composers, and music historians have not been willing to take Puccini at face value. Tosca, 1900, for example, has taken some major critical hits over the years. This would seem not to be a terribly big deal. Lots of the operas that we've listened to across the span of this course were received poorly, or at least received not as we receive them today, at their premieres. They were not all big hits from the very beginning. But almost 100 years after its premiere, Tosca, and indeed Puccini himself, continue to be assailed by some composers and some critics, despite the fact that they have been the mainstay of the repertoire since their creation. Now, this is a very unusual state of affairs, my friends, that operas that have been intrinsic and core repertoire would be 100 years later questioned evermore by composers and critics. Usually it's the other way around. The critics abuse a piece at its premiere, it survives 100 years, and then everyone embraces it as having been intrinsic to its age, whether the contemporaries acknowledged it or not. The other way around. These pieces have been central repertoire and are now being abused. And this is the Puccinian dilemma. I would read you some fairly contemporary critical response towards Puccini. According to critic Harold Schoenberg, who for many years was the chief critic of the New York Times, "The Puccini operas may be naive, and musicians have accused them of pandering to a listener's baser instincts. There's no denying that many Puccini operas are frank tearjerkers, and those who regard opera as an art of spiritual betterment reject them out of hand. According to composer Arnold Schoenberg, no relation, please, there are higher and lower means of artistic expression. Realistic, violent incidents, as, for example, the torture scene in the second act of Tosca, which are unfailingly effective, should not be used by an artist because they are too cheap, too accessible to everybody. According to composer Benjamin Britten, who wrote marvelous operas himself, I am sickened by the cheapness and emptiness of Puccini's music. And there, twice we've heard that word, cheap. And we're not talking about birdsong here. According to the ordinarily unassailable musicologist Joseph Kerman, quote, the more fully one knows the true achievement of the art of opera, the more clearly one sees the extent of Puccini's failure as an opera composer, or more correctly, the triviality of his attempt. Tosca, for example, is consistently throughout of cafe music banality. It is scarcely believable that such an opera could have become a favorite. Tosca is a shabby little shocker. Unquote. Well, my goodness. Great composers and great musicologists alike have trashed Puccini and Tosca, flushed both the composer and his opera down the toilet of taste into the Tiber. Oh my, oh my. Why then am I presenting this composer, this opera to you, my dear friends and listeners? Because, and heaven help me, my poor, simple soul, I'm crazy about Tosca. Color me cheap, color me easy, an operatic slut, fine, I can live with all of that. But I cannot live without Puccini, and particularly, I will not live without Tosca. It's a necessary pleasure, if perhaps a guilty one. I'll be straight with you. If Tosca's saccharine sweet melodies, melodramatic duets, sadomasochistic scenes of torture and date rape don't tear out your heart and stomp on it and make you weep like an idiot, then, one, you are simply too smart for the rest of us. Two, your sophistication has developed to a point where you are no longer capable of appreciating the basic things in life, like a great chili dog, a sloppy kiss, a perfectly executed double play, or a 57 Chevy convertible. I mean, do we deny ourselves ice cream because it's fattening? Do we not drink martinis because they have alcohol? And thirdly, if this opera don't tear out your heart and stomp on it, you are no longer able to kick back, let it hang, and just have a good old time. To Puccini's and Tosca's critics, I say, lighten up. Let it go, man. Let it go. Wallow in the fat just for the cheap, bloody hell of it. And there, I used the word cheap, too. As we should all know by now, opera has almost always been a popular entertainment in Italy. So why shouldn't late 19th, early 20th century Italian opera, a la Puccini, be an essentially popular art? Well, popular art it is. But all that is popular is not necessarily kitsch, and all that is kitsch is not necessarily bad. So please, let us enjoy, celebrate, and revel in, indeed submerge ourselves in, the glorious soap opera that is Puccini's Tosca. I feel much better now. Thank you very much. All right. Tosca, 1900. The action takes place in Rome. The large outline of the story is based on historical events. In the wake of the French Revolution, which began in 1789, a spirit of freedom and nationalism sweeps across the Italian peninsula. The French, seen as liberators, march on Rome in 1798. The French established a Roman Republic in Rome, and this is where the Tosca story kicks in. Cesare Angelotti is assigned as one of the governors of Rome, one of the two co-governing consuls. Now, the combined forces of Britain, Austria, and Russia drive the French out of Rome. A brutal secret police force is created to keep order in the city. And this police force is headed by the evil Baron Vitellio Scarpia. We have a job. And here's the job for all of us. Every time I mention the name Scarpia, You must hiss quietly, as Europeans would. And I will play the music that is associated with Scarpia. This is the Scarpian leitmotif. It represents all that is bad, low, and evil in this opera. And if nothing else, you will know it quite by heart by the time we finish our exploration of Tosca. I'm testing you. Scarpia! Very good. All right. Cesare Angelotti, one of those two consuls appointed by the French liberators, has been imprisoned for treason against the state. The action of the opera takes place against this background over the course of a single day in June of 1800. The curtain rises on Act One just as Angelotti has escaped from the prison in the Castel San Angelo. All right, the dramatic structure of the opera. The libretto is by Giuseppe Giacosa and Luigi Illica. By the way, Giacosa and Illica, together with Puccini, were known in their day as the Holy Trinity. Everything they touched turned to gold, or perhaps we should say to lira. This opera is based on the play La Tosca by Victorien Sardou, a French playwright very taken with realism and naturalism. It's a typical three-act structure. Act one, we meet the characters and the dramatic situation. Act two, the action. And I will tell you now, what we're going to do when we begin exploring this opera is we're going to listen to the great bulk of Act two. I will read as much of the libretto as time allows me to read, but it's Act two, where the action takes place, that really should be the focal point of our attention, and so it shall be. Act three is the denouement, the moment of truth, when all the loose strings are tied together and revelation occurs. It is the response to the action of Act Two. All right, quickly, let me outline what happens in Act One. We can't do Act Two without knowing what preceded it. The action takes place in the church of San Andrea della Valle. The painter and masculine tenor hunk hero, Mario Cavaradossi, is painting from memory a portrait of a beautiful young woman that he has seen in the church. Enter Cesare Angelotti, who has just escaped. He lets himself into his family chapel with a key that's been left behind by his sister. Now, the woman that Cavaradossi has painted turns out to be Angelotti's sister, who has left behind in the family chapel food and a disguise for her brother. The jailbreak has obviously been well planned. Cavaradossi and Angelotti meet, and Cavaradossi offers to hide Angelotti in a well on the grounds of his, Cavaradossi's, villa. So Cavaradossi gets involved right away. He shouldn't be, but he involves himself. Enter Floria Tosca, Angelotti's heartthrob. She is a beautiful, passionate, talented singer of great popularity and fame. She is also the object of the evil Scarpia's desire. Bravo. All right. Scarpia enters the church. Cavaradossi has just departed, so their paths do not cross. Scarpia enters in search of Angelotti. Scarpia immediately recognizes Angelotti's sister in Cavaradossi's painting, which is still sitting on an easel in the church. And then Scarpia discovers Angelotti's discarded disguise, the disguise that he didn't need because he was going to go hide in the well of Cavaradossi's house. Oh, Scarpia is not a dumb man, and he puts due e due together, and he realizes that Cavaradossi is in some way involved with Angelotti's escape. Bravissimo.